This very nimble playing is on a very rare old recording of a waltz by Chopin. The player is a very handsome Australian who started life as the son of a small-town Queensland publican in the 1880s and ended up as the high toast, or the toast of, high society in London. Now, this bloke's name is Edward Carle, and he lived a very big life. He had real adventures. He witnessed the great events of European history from the dress circle, you might say. This recording belongs to Eddie Carle's great-nephew, Michael Moran, who himself once aspired to be a concert pianist and who writes very powerfully about music, actually. Michael tells Uncle Eddie's life in a very smart and engaging biography called The Pocket Paderewski. Michael joins us from Warsaw, where he lives. Welcome, Michael. What drew you as a pianist to this story?
I just felt very attracted to, particularly after I heard him play on these recordings that I'd inherited many, many years before, which I had never in fact played. And the impression was indelible, really.
The impression that he was a special pianist. Michael,
absolutely. Yes.
Michael, the most moving part of the book for me was the end, where you explained why you loved your great uncle Eddie so much. In old age, when he was dying, he gave you some inspirational advice about how to play, and he said that he thought you should communicate the, quote, sexual electricity within the music without fear. What did he mean by that?
Well, I've often analysed that myself. It's something that Arthur Rubinstein understood very well. Rubinstein believed that there was an emanation from the artist. That's why you should go to live concerts. There was actually an electrical emanation from the artist to the audience. Perhaps that's what Eddie was talking about. It's this magic dust that comes from some pianists.
Well, let's hear him sprinkling his magic dust on a piece that you say was his signature tune or his calling card. It's La Campanella by Franz Liszt. Just briefly explain why this was so significant for him.
Well, it was his showpiece. He was a very small man and he could scarcely stretch an octave. This was what's so extraordinary about the performance of La Campanella. With a small hand, you have to do very large leaps across the entire compass of the keyboard. And it's a very demanding piece for people even with a normal-sized hand. Liszt gave him no problems whatsoever.
Here it is. This is La Campanella. There he is. He's absolutely got it with such grace and elegance, and not showy, really.
This is what struck me, his refinement of tone and the vitality of his playing, this sort of feathery velocity that he had, this extraordinary touch, which was very common among late 19th century virtuosi.
Well, you've gone to some trouble to assemble opinions from leading musicians about the quality of his playing, and, for example, the great Australian pianist Leslie Howard calls him a marvellous musician and a great artist. So his life is a sort of Billy Elliot story, really. He grew up in the town of, is it Beenleigh? Is that how you say it?
That's right.
Beenleigh, which is about 20 k's south of Brisbane. This is in 1885 he's born. So it would have been a pretty wild and woolly place at the end of the 19th century.
You're not kidding. You're not kidding. If you see pictures of the rifle club and the rugby club, yes, it was pretty wild.
So how did he learn to play among all these shooters and rugby players?
It was very unusual for a boy, as you might imagine, in Australia, to want to play the piano in 1885. He actually began to play with lessons from the wife of the milkman, who used to give these lessons to him secretly, a Mrs. Bale. And then he really was a natural talent. This is why I was so impressed with him. He really had very, very few formal piano lessons, never attended a conservatorium. And in fact, most of his early pianistic life was in the traveling silent cinema, which used to go through the outback of Australia, taking silent films. Then he played with an extraordinary group known as the Dandies, entertaining Australians in different capital cities. It's a fascinating story, you know, early Australian vaudeville and the whole life of open-air theatres in Australia. It's very, very little covered in literature.
You could set a movie right there, all that, you know, wonderful experience he had playing for the silent movies. Anyway, he chums up with a tenor whose name is George Brooke, who sounds like this.
Loves I've known are buried in the past. I couldn't last with you. None of them could ever hold me fast in the way you do.
And they go off on a concert tour, and as you say, they have these astonishing adventures. They perform in Asia, and we can't go into all of that. People have to read your book, but they end up in London, where they rapidly work themselves into the most elite social circles. How did they achieve that?
What's very interesting, really, and we're going through his entire career, is the fact that he was Australian. Actually, more specifically, from Queensland. He never made any attempt to disguise his accent or his Australian openness, friendliness, and charm. He was given a number of letters of introduction by Lady Stradbrooke, and also, of course, Dame Nellie Melba, who heard him in Adelaide and was terribly impressed with his playing. And she gave him letters of introduction. And this immediately catapulted him into a society, high society, a society that's been completely forgotten. I mean, Nancy Mitford referred to this with some sadness. Eddie and George were projected into this mainly through the good offices of Sir Edward Wallington, who was the knight treasurer to the Queen, but he had had a very significant Australian career. And when he heard about these brilliant Australian musicians, who were quite famous in Australia at that time, he decided to try and organise a concert for Queen Mary. If you did give a concert for the Queen, which he did in a private house, this was on the 1st of July 1924. The concert was published in what was known as the Court Circular. Now, the Court Circular, I think it's still published in the Telegraph in London, and it tells you exactly what the royal family are doing. And of course, their name was printed in this. So, I mean, from that moment on, they became much sought after by society.
Mm. Yeah, well, if you played for the Queen, I guess everybody who's got aspirations to some standing in society would like you to play at their place. I mean, they end up playing at the Albert Hall. It's an immensely impressive record of engagements they have in London in the 20s. On Aaron, this is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart, and my guest is Michael Moran, and we're talking about his biography of the Australian pianist Edward Carl, who was Michael's, what was he, your great uncle? Is that what he is?
Yes, that's right. Yes, great uncle. Mm.
Let's hear him now, Edward, that is, playing the famous Chopin Polonaise in A-flat, a big showy piece, this one. Up that big scale there. Now, it's easy to give that Chopin piece the sort of Liberace treatment. It is very showy, offy, but it seems to me he plays with a very classy combination of bravura and restraint. I mean, you do feel as though you're hearing the music rather than just admiring the playing.
Yes, well, the indication Chopin gave to the Polonaise was Allegro maestoso, and in fact, it's very maestoso, the way he plays this.
So majestic.
Yes, and Chopin is an extraordinarily accessible composer and yet inaccessible. He really is a terribly mysterious and ambiguous composer in many ways. And I've come to learn this living in Poland, very much so.
And do you feel that there's something about Eddie's playing that gets into that mystery?
Absolutely. And I personally have this conviction that Chopin was a composer who balanced his masculine and feminine sides very, very successfully. And in many ways, pianists either take up the feminine side or exaggerate the masculine side. And very few pianists can achieve this wonderful, may I even say, androgynous balance.
Well, in 1930, George, his partner, the tenor, died. He died in Melbourne of a brain tumour. But Eddie's career continues. And by 1935, as you explain, he's moving among British aristocrats, among whom an enthusiasm for the Nazis is commonplace. I mean, it was quite Absolutely. Common in the 30s for the social elite to believe that democracy was a ghastly experiment that had failed, and what we needed was a bit of backbone back in society, and the Nazis were just the thing the world needed. Where did he stand on that?
Well, you must remember he was at least half German, and his father was Irish, his mother was German, and he had a sort of interest in exploring his own psyche. That's why he went to Germany with his lover, Sabine Adler, an Austrian violinist. I would say many of his patrons felt sympathy for Germany after Versailles.
Just to explain that Versailles is the agreement or the treaty, the terms of peace that are reached after the First World War. And there was a widespread view and a not unfounded view that Germany came off very badly from that, in that it was forced to pay reparations that really crippled the country. And there were many people who thought that that wasn't a fair settlement. And Hitler was able to rise to power on the public view in Germany that had to be put right.
The other reason he went to Germany, apart from the concert tour, of course, I mean, it was a very short concert tour, but he, of course, disliked the militarism, was horrified by it. In his private life, his lover became infatuated with a Nazi officer and left him.
Let's just unpack that a bit more. So he goes to Germany with this woman, Sabine Adler, who is a violinist, and she's now the partner in the act, essentially. George has gone.
That's right.
Sabine has stepped in. Now he's got a violinist he plays with. They go to Germany as a couple. They're romantically involved as well as being an artistic pair.
Yes.
But she is more in love with fascism, it seems to me, than she is with him. And she leaves him for a fascist officer.
That's right. I mean, they looked very impressive, these chaps. The Nazi uniform was very glamorous. I mean, we tend to overlook this and demonize these people, but they didn't, you know, they didn't achieve the influence they had without great cosmetic assistance.
Michael, you did feed me clues or tantalizing hints that perhaps his own sexual orientation was an issue for him. That one, I mean, maybe the reason Sabine left him is because he really wasn't a man who loved women.
This only came, I suppose, looking at his address book, which had a number of addresses of rather notorious places in Cannes on the French Riviera, frequented by Jean Cocteau and others. And I just wondered why these addresses might be in his address book.
Well, one of them is a famous gay bar, perhaps the most famous gay bar of the time, called the Zanzibar.
That's right.
I mean, you write, with respect, you write in your book, one can only speculate about what Eddie may have been doing. I mean, I thought that was like saying he went to a pizza shop and you can only speculate on what he ate there.
Well, he didn't inhale, yes. It's just that I don't think it's particularly relevant. Apart from the fact that it was a criminal offence, he was a very good Catholic, and also I think under great nervous tension because of this orientation question. And I could never really understand why he had a number of nervous breakdowns in the light of his great success as an artist.
See, you say it's not relevant, but a man who describes the essence of music as being a kind of sexual energy, a man who never gets married but is clearly so eligible and handsome and sociable, and a man who is suffering some kind of mental distress at the end, does seem to me to invite some...
Well, you couldn't. I mean, in those days, if you've read about Auden or any of those musicians, poets, writers, painters, the social pressure was enormous.
Michael, a challenging part of your story is that he never stops being a performer for the rich elite. He spends the whole of the Second World War living in a sort of luxurious state of depression, sponsored by wealthy aristocrats in neutral territory. I wonder whether you ever felt, as you were writing this, that he had wasted his talent, that he might have been able to live a more authentic life or have more impact with his playing if he had been able to shake off that closeted world in which he lived and perhaps forge a career as a concert pianist. Was that ever an option for him, do you think?
No. And oddly enough, I mean, you know, when you investigate a member of your own family in great detail, the number of resonances you find in your own life is quite unsettling and, in fact, very helpful to come to terms with yourself. Eddie's big problem was he did this too late, and it was also my problem. In those days, if you were born in Australia, it was very unusual for an Australian artist to have a high profile in London. I mean, I can only think of Melba, Florence Austral, who was a great, great singer, inspired Joan Sutherland, and Percy Grainger. What you have to realise is that he really was recognised, let's say, by Alfred Cortot, which he was, and by Frau Gombrich, who was the pupil of Leczytiski, very late in his life. He would have been 45, 50 perhaps, taking these lessons. And I had exactly the same experience, because by the time I got to Europe to study seriously, I was already 25. Too late to build a repertoire and to build a career, even in those days. So I've never felt that he was actually simply a social butterfly. I just think, see, what you've got to remember is that the Second World War destroyed many, many concert careers, particularly of Russian pianists. And in my own investigations, you know, it's a question of luck when you were doing your work. And yes, it was privileged. But when you think of the period he spent in Switzerland during the war, it was a period of enormous generosity. He gave enormous number of charity recitals when he was ill. He had various illnesses apart from nervous breakdowns. One wonderful description is by a French journalist who described a group of Polish officers in a church that he played Chopin for. And at the beginning of the recital, they were in ramrod posture. And as the Chopin broke over them like a great wave, they gradually began to collapse and then began to sob. And it's a very, very moving description of the power.
Well, Michael, I have loved reading this book. It's not just a journey through a man's life. It's a journey through the 20th century, full of astonishing tales and marvellous characters. And it is a real privilege to have actually stood where he stood and have known the people he knew and seen the 20th century as he saw it. And you've written it so evocatively, and I'm so grateful to you for coming on the show. It's been just lovely to talk.
It's very, very kind of you. I myself feel that this is a great Australian story.
The book's called The Pocket Paderewski, The Beguiling Life of the Australian Concert Pianist Edward Carl, and it's published by Australian Scholarly Publishing. And Paderewski, I should say, is a famous Polish pianist who was a generation older than Carl.